We're delighted to be recorded by Kabu, and we're also delighted to be here. Both Bob and I have not merely appeared on Kabu, but we have also been fundraisers for this station. Done pledge drives, and we absolutely love doing it. We're probably the biggest fans of pledge drives around. We know no listeners are, but we like them. Because we shamelessly like to raise money for media that we think is honorable, that challenges the existing order, and that maybe opens up the dialogue in a way that the media that we so often criticize closes it. So thank you for being here tonight. We hope that you will give shameless and unimaginable amounts of money to this station. And we also thank our dear friend Bill Resnick, former golf star in Milwaukee, for being, you know, largely and perhaps most importantly our substitute wheelman today as we've roared around Portland and gone to all kinds of really good events. And Bill is a great friend and a great comrade, and he just loves this station and talks it up at levels that really get rather boring after a while. So we're honored to be with him. We also want to introduce Jordan Berg over here in the corner. Bob and I, you know, we went on a bender one night and started a little group called Free Press, which is the nation's media reform network with our comrade Josh Silver. And Free Press has grown from some whiners who sat around and complained about things to, thanks to the work of others, to an organization that now has 600,000 folks associated with it across this country, and that has been intimately involved in a lot of the central battles over media policy in the United States, net neutrality, media consolidation, the funding of public and community broadcasting, not merely through pledge drives and events like this, but also through a government that ought to have some commitment, some real commitment, to having a diverse and competitive and dissenting media. And Jordan is the outreach director and has been working himself like crazy to do all kinds of wonderful stuff. And we finally want to thank Kabu for providing food, because we are on the second or third day. I don't even know. I guess it's third day.
I've lost track.
Third day of a pretty wild and fabulous book tour that's taken us to, you know, really we've seen all of America now, Seattle and Portland, and the way in between in the middle of the night. And these have been fabulous events. Hundreds of people coming out, great crowds, great energy. It reassures Bob and myself about our commitment to focus on issues of media and democracy because the people are there, and it's just wonderful. But, you know, the best thing about this tour that we're on right now is that we have Jordan with us, and Jordan is there to get the names, right? You know, he gets people excited. Bob and I used to do this all the time. We'd really get a crowd going, you know. Maybe it's an odd night, and I wish you could have seen us on an odd night. But it was an odd night, you know, and everybody's on their feet, they're cheering and everything like that. And then we'd, you know, take off and never see him again. The genius of Jordan, he gets the names, and then we make them part of our elaborate scheme to, you know, change the media and make America a democracy. So, but we're here tonight to actually talk about the Obama era in which we now find ourselves. And we speak very, very briefly because your questions are going to drive this and make it so much better than what we would say. But I will tell you this. I cover Obama for a living. I get paid to pay attention to Barack Obama. And as a result, I am not as disappointed in him as some people. And I'm not going to make any aspersions and say that everybody in this room is disappointed or excited or loves or hates or any of that. That's not. But we know from polling, the new Washington Post ABC News poll, for instance, that a really substantial number of people who voted for Barack Obama are very disappointed. They're not happy with the current moment. In fact, among Obama backers, we are getting very close to a majority now saying that he has not kept the promises of his campaign. And that's a disappointment level that is unsettling and complicated. It also has a real political overlay. Last night in Massachusetts, the voters of Massachusetts elected a conservative Republican to Ted Kennedy's seat. Now, this is anomalous. This is not something. The last Republican that Massachusetts sent to the U.S. Senate was a black guy who opposed the war in Vietnam and stood to the left of George McGovern on many issues. That was a Massachusetts Republican. Now, they, Ed Brooke, who is a really good guy, still around, he's 90 years old. But they now have elected a pretty conservative guy who clearly rode the wave of a lot of resentment. It's very important that you understand, he did not win because a lot of Obama backers switched their allegiance. It wasn't that the people who voted last year, a little over a year ago, for Barack Obama said, "Oh, I'm that's done. I'm joining the Tea Party, right? I'm going to move on over." No, that's not at all what's happening. In this moment, the right is super energized. You don't have to open the polling places for them. They'll stand out front and wait. And it's a fundamental reality of this moment. They're hyper energized, and I think we should be very blunt about why they are energized. It's a host of issues, but one of them is the fact that something about Obama does not make sense to them. They really don't understand how this guy can be president. And if you go, I've been to many Tea Party events, I've interviewed these folks. They're not the most horrible people or anything like that. They're actually, mostly working class Americans, but they really can't make sense of the fact that an African American guy that frankly they'd never really heard of is now the president of the United States. It just doesn't feel right to them. And so it's one of the reasons why in polling, the clear majority believes he wasn't born here. And they believe all sorts of really conspiratorial and kind of wild stuff. But at core, it is an inability to understand the progression of their country. Forget about Obama. It is that this country might actually elect an African-American, might actually elect somebody whose name ended in a vowel. All sorts of things that didn't quite seem right to them. And they're highly energized. They're very, very passionate. They feel very, very much that they are on the march at this moment, that this is their rising time. But I have slightly bad news for him. When you look at the actual breakdown of the turnout, the biggest problem was that progressives, I don't mean the people, hardcore activists that go out and do things day to day, but, people who have a progressive inclination, they tend to be a little on the left, many of them so disappointed by the decision to surge more troops into Afghanistan and also by a health care bill that seems to be so dumbed down from the promise of single payer and reforms that really did appeal to an awfully lot of progressives, just couldn't get energized by this race in Massachusetts. And this is a huge problem for the Obama presidency and the Democratic Party at this point. Because if liberal Democrats and independent progressives, the kind of the base, and frankly, what formed a very substantial voting block in this country, that block cannot be drawn to the polls with great energy, we have a real problem as regards where we're heading. Now, it doesn't mean you have to like Obama or dislike Obama. That's not the point. It's that failure to come to the polls is going to impact the overall policy making of the Republic. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. It's no secret that Barack Obama excited young people. I mean, it's a big deal. Young people got energized. In fact, we kind of overplayed it because, the media loves, the youth are interested. And so we kind of really got excited about it, maybe overplayed some aspects of it, but there was a youth excitement. Now, here's an interesting thing. What is the one group in America that says we should have gay marriage right now? I don't have to kind of wrap my head around, partnerships or domestic this or that. You offer same-sex marriage. Let's go for it. People under 30, right? What is the group in America where the plurality says they prefer socialism to capitalism, right? I mean, that's because I know we can't mention the word socialism, right? Well, do you know that it actually helps Obama if they call him a socialist? With people under 30, because we actually have a plurality that says they, given the choice, they think, I don't think they even know what socialism is. It's not like our public education system's teaching them that. But, Sarah Palin is saying that, she's against socialism, and they're like, well, okay, socialism must be pretty good. And so these young folks who got so energized, right, this is a very progressive, very positive voting force. It isn't just that they're young and we like to have fresh, good-looking folks come into our events. No, these are people who really do drive the process. If they get disappointed, if they get disengaged,
It doesn't matter what Barack Obama does. It doesn't matter who he is. You take these people out of the process, and we fall back into that very, very dangerous zone where politicians know exactly what the electorate is going to be. There's nothing more dangerous in American civic life than a politician who knows exactly what the electorate is, because he or she can tailor their message right into that narrow 51%, get it, and be done. They don't have to listen to anybody anymore. It becomes a very, very easy thing. What the Obama campaign did was bring a whole bunch of people in who were volatile, brought different ideas, libertarian conservatives, and, you know, didn't like the war. You know, libertarians who don't like the war and didn't like Bush, and so they're for Obama. Okay, that's good. There's something cool in there, right? You know, I mean, I don't know, but it's good. And all the way over to socialists and moderate Republicans, and they're all kind of churning around. Now it's starting to sort out again. And I'll close with a quick notion here. Barack Obama, as a president, is the luckiest politician I have covered in a very, very long time, because he got his wake-up call in January. That is really healthy. Bill Clinton got his wake-up call in November of 1994. And they lost control of the House and Senate, and his presidency was effectively finished as a definitional presidency. It became a partnership triangulation presidency, which, you know, achieved some things, but was not nearly what it might have or frankly should have been. If Obama falls into that trap, he could still be president easily for an 8-year period. That could easily happen. But it will be a presidency defined not by his goals and his, frankly, remarkable skills in many areas, but by his need to compromise with other folks. Mm-hmm. And November of this year will decide that. But in January, you get the wake-up call. So what you have to watch for right now is, what will Barack Obama and the Democrats, this is not just him, it's a broader grouping, what will they do in reaction to the loss of Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts, a state that hasn't voted for a Republican for president in a quarter century, that sends an entirely Democrat, up until today, an entirely Democratic delegation to Congress? This ain't a swing state. This is, you're getting a conservative come from there. Okay, that's a wake-up call. Let's pay attention. There are two gradations. One way to go is to say, wow, I am listening to the media punditocracy. You know, I was flipping it in my hotel, saw that Fox station, and they're saying I'm too liberal. I've done too much. I've been overly ambitious. I've been too much of a change. America doesn't want this stuff. And so I'm going to dial it down. You know, kind of go back to that moderate, post-partisan place that everybody feels good and nothing really happens. And that's one choice. And there will be great pressure on Barack Obama to make that choice, to go for caution and say, I've been too radical over this last year. If he does that, I can tell you that Karl Rove and his friends will be popping champagne corks. Right? Because they still get to call him a socialist, even if he, you know, no matter what he does. I mean, Barack Obama could go and spend every day polishing Ronald Reagan's grave. And so they, oh, see, it's a socialist polish on that grave. And so it doesn't matter. So if Obama moves to the right, it's a dream come true. Because A, he doesn't deliver anything. He doesn't energize his base at all. He doesn't excite people, right? But they still get to call him a socialist. So works very, very well. Our hope, my hope, as somebody who's covered politics for a very, very long time in a lot of different settings, is that Barack Obama realizes that he is presiding over an incredibly turbulent economic moment in this country, where we have double-digit unemployment for the first time in a quarter century, where we really have a 17 to 18% unemployment rate when you include people who've given up looking for work and people who are underemployed, and where in many key parts, swing areas of this country, we have unemployment rates that go into the 20s and 30s. And in states like Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, states where the Democrats built their majorities in 2006 and 2008, very vulnerable places. If Barack Obama realizes and recognizes fully that he is serving as president in this incredibly volatile moment, and that that reality that I just described is the most fundamental political reality of the moment, and if he mobilizes his administration, and frankly his party, to address that, to get very, very serious about unemployment, joblessness, the frustration that goes with it, the endemic long-term concerns about it in many parts of this country. Even if he doesn't completely reverse the situation, if there's a sense of progress on that and a sense of energy, I think Democrats won't have that bad a year. I think they'll be churning, they may lose some stuff, but it'll be functional. And frankly, if they get around the Republicans and get serious about this banking issue. This gentleman asked me, can we possibly keep Bernanke from being head of the Fed again? Look, if they get ahead of that, there's still great potential here politically. But I will tell you, that's what we ought to watch for. Those of you who do news and commentary shows on here, keep an eye for that, because that's really the critical thing. Does Obama choose, and do the Democrats choose, to be aggressively progressive populist on economic issues, and particularly on banking issues, and as their core goal to shift Wall Street toward Main Street, clearly identify themselves on Main Street? I think this is a wonderful wake-up call, very, very healthy. Yesterday, Masters, a really good thing to have happen. On the other hand, go toward caution. You may have a lot of time to explore the joys of being in opposition and dealing with some really tough things. So, most volatile time of the Obama presidency so far, incredible moment that we're at. Wonderful to be with such a good and smart group of people to talk about it. I'm going to turn you over now to a guy who's a media scholar, and he gets all sorts of, you know, pop the champagne corks, get excited, Bob McChesney. You know. But who also happens to be one of the most brilliant political economists that I've ever dealt with, and I've dealt with a lot of them in a lot of settings. And Bob's analysis of politics, especially as it interweaves with economic issues, is, I would venture to say, as significant in many ways, perhaps more, than his analysis of media, which I know so many people in this room know him for. So please, let me offer you Bob McChesney.
Oh. Please, Glenn. Well, I like the introduction a lot, John. You see, don't want to go on?
And he's handsome, I might say, to our radio listeners should know how good-looking he is.
Well, thanks for coming. I'm going to talk a little bit about community radio first, a few words. I have a radio show now on the NPR affiliate in Illinois called Media Matters, WILL, and should play them. And they said, oh, okay, we'll give your show a shot on the NPR station. And it's probably the only NPR station in the country it would let me have a show. In fact, I think it's a safe statement that it's the only one. And it's a great credit to that station. And John and I do pledge drives to that station twice a year to pay them back. And the entire progressive community of the state and the country, in many respects, call us to pledge money to let that station know they want the sort of programming that allows me to have a weekly show for an hour and do the sort of issues I'm interested in doing. But it's all due to community radio. And I understand that I'm at NPR. I'm not on solid ground. But when I'm here, I'm home. And it's Wart is where I got started. And one of the things I love to do, with the success that John and I have had, sometimes we can help raise money for stations. So it's imperative to us to always do pledge drives for community stations whenever we possibly can. Because these are the stations that are, in my view, our lifeline to making sense of the world in moments of crisis. When the economy goes down, NPR, like the commercial news media, are basically spoon-feeding us the conventional wisdom. It's these stations that actually are cutting through the crap and giving us a critical analysis that isn't wed to people in power. When we're invading countries like Afghanistan or doing some military escalation, it's the community stations that are our voices that go against the grain, and regrettably not the NPR stations too often. And I say that having supported some NPR stations quite a bit. And it's these stations that we need desperately to strengthen and keep strong. And two things I'd add to that is that we travel a lot, and one thing you notice really quickly is if you're a city that doesn't have a good community station, the entire culture of the city is different. Community stations, when they're successful, bring a community together, give it a voice and identity that really strengthens the quality of life there, the quality of participation in public life. There's no price tag you can put on the difference between a city with and without a good community station. I mean, you just can't replace it. If something like KBOO goes down, you can't recreate it. It's almost priceless, and it's a treasure to have a community station like this. The other bit of news I'd say is that, unfortunately, just having a community station doesn't mean it works well. And without naming names, there are a lot of communities that have community stations that one time rode high. There are shambles now. They've gotten caught up in all sorts of internecine warfare, fighting over who gets the show there and who gets the show there. Stuff that I think we're all too familiar with. Even the best stations have had this. WRT, the station I love in Madison, went through it but got out of it, fortunately. Because people were able to rise above petty disputes and look at the bigger picture, what was good for the entire community. And, you know, I don't know the details of KBOO, but I have no doubt that KBOO has had its share of this, too, because human beings are here, and that's what goes on. Any organization that's community-based is going to have tensions. That's unavoidable. But having said that, my sense is KBOO is it's a genuine community station that really is one of the handful of crown jewels in this country. And I say that not just from my dealings with the station over the air or visiting it today, but when I go around and talk to people around the country and they say, okay, let's talk about community radio, KBOO's name always comes up as, you know, there's this great station in Portland named KBOO. Okay, of course I know KBOO. There's only like three or four that I'd say fit that description, and KBOO is always one of them. Those of you who support it, and I can tell by looking in this room, we've got some high rollers. We thank you.
Oh, yeah, where?
There. You know, thank you for doing it. It's really, it's spectacularly important. And the one thing I know from community radio is that the money never gets wasted at community radio. You know, it's not like it goes to pay for junkets to Las Vegas or martini lunches or hot tub baths for the management. This money always goes to pay for just the equipment, the utilities, the fundamentals that you have to have a functioning community radio station. And I can't think of a better use of money at the local level for media if you're just going to create media. I really think it's the best way to get the most bang for your dollar and help build a healthy, vibrant institution. So that's what I think about KBOO, and that's what I think about community radio. And so thank you who have been supporting it, and please continue to do so. Get your friends to do so. And you can't give too much. So thank you. Now, let's say a little bit about Obama. I agree with what John said. But I'll tell you a story about Obama that I thought was interesting. As you might remember, during the presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton and Sean Hannity and later Sarah Palin made a big deal about Obama's connection to a guy named Bill Ayers, University of Chicago professor. And it first came up, it became a lot of prominence in the debate in Philadelphia, I think it was. The last debate Obama and Clinton had, I think. One of the last. And, you know, it was all of a sudden they spent half the debate talking about, did Obama know this guy Bill Ayers in Chicago, who was a notorious weather underground terrorist, and, you know, how could we elect a president who knew this guy in his neighborhood? And Obama downplayed it. He said, I guess I passed this guy in the street. He's like a professor of social anthropology. And it made it sound like he barely knew the guy. Like he might have bumped into him once in the hood, but, you know, otherwise just some weird guy. And so as fate would have it, literally 3 days after that big televised primary, I was going to Chicago to do a benefit for Monthly Review magazine at the home of Bill Ayers. And I got there early, and I got to have dinner with Bill and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, before the event. It was just the three of us. And so I said, hey, okay, Ayers, what's the story here? And what's the story with Obama? He says, well, first of all, he knows me a lot better than he said. He knows I'm a professor of education. And he spent a lot more time with me than he's letting on. But, you know, and he didn't mind. Ayers was laughing when he said it. And I said, well, what's the guy like? And he said, well, they used to come over here all the time and sit in our backyard and barbecues. He used to live right over there. You know, Farrakhan lives the block over there. It's this neighborhood in Chicago, sort of the black upper middle class and the intelligentsia. It's a beautiful neighborhood in the south side of Chicago, a gorgeous neighborhood. And, you know, the mosque is over there. And it's just a really tight-knit neighborhood. And we hung out all the time. And when he first ran for Senate, you know, he announced it in the backyard to Ayers and their friends there, and they were talking. And he said, I haven't seen him as much recently, obviously. And I said, well, what's he like? Is he a communist? I mean, no. I was like, am I? And he said, well, but you got to know about Obama or a few things. First of all, he's extraordinarily smart. He's the smartest guy in any room he goes into. Secondly, he's incredibly ambitious, completely ambitious. Third, he is a complete mainstream corporate Democrat. He doesn't have a progressive bone in his body. And fourth, he's a really nice guy. He's not an asshole. And I thought, well, that seems like a pretty accurate description of the guy I saw, and I thought that all the way. But I think in the last year I've changed my opinion. I think Ayers is batting 750. I don't think he's that intelligent anymore. He might score well in GREs, but I think that my hope for Obama was that he was intelligent, and he would have been smart enough to realize, as John was talking about, the conventional Bill Clinton corporate Democrat playbook that he's adopted. That might work in other times, in conventional times, but we're in times of deep crisis where the conventional playbook is a failure. And in economic policy, in foreign policy, environmental policy, on and on and on, we have problems that are enormous and they aren't going away. And the traditional corporate Democrat, traditional range of debate solutions economically and politically are not helping, they're fiascos. And my hope was, not that Obama really was a progressive, even though Franklin Roosevelt was a progressive, he'd been a conservative Democrat, but he'd be smart enough to realize that. You know, if I do the Ben Bernanke playbook for the economy, I'm going to have tons of people unemployed, and that's not going to change, and I'll make bankers happy, but, you know, that's not who voted me into office. My votes, my base didn't come from bankers. The people who were out there on Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon, all those weekends for election, weren't the bankers. You know, they were the people getting screwed over by the bankers. And that's why I thought he'd be smart enough to figure that part out. Not that he cared that much, but just be smart. He's that a bright guy. He can figure that's what he'd have to do. So I've been disappointed that he wasn't that smart, that he didn't really add it up. And I guess in John's case, he'll give him another chance. We'll see if he's smart enough now to figure out that if he continues this sort of path that he's on, he has a chance, in my view, to go down as one of the worst, if not the worst, presidents in the country's history. And I'll explain why. It won't be his policies are worse than George W. Bush's. They're largely an economic policy and foreign policy indistinguishable. I mean, it's the exact same team in both. Gates' defense, so no real difference. And as John McCain said when he was on Meet the Press a few weeks ago, they asked him to criticize Obama's foreign policy. I can't. It's exactly what I would have done. So there was no difference. In foreign policy, we might as well have had no change in power. In economic policy, he's got Bernanke, the Republican guy, Geithner, basically the banker's guy, the right-wing Republican guy. So the two most important things governments do, financial, business policy, economic policy, and foreign policy, his policies have been indistinguishable for all intents and purposes from what McCain would have done and from his predecessors. And obviously that's a political crisis of the highest magnitude because the people elected him. If you told all those kids under the age of 30 who organized for him that extraordinary base he did help develop, you're going to get the same foreign policy and the same economic policy, same people that you've been busting your butt to get out of office. You know, it would have been an interesting conversation prior to Election Day in 2008. That certainly wasn't what people were voting, planning on. And so I think right now, why I say he could go as the worst president isn't that he's bad per se, but I think by basically taking a generation and his voting base and not delivering anything and alienating them from politics on one hand, and not doing what I thought he had an excellent chance to do in November of 2008, which was basically take the far right in this country, which I thought was this far from extinction for a generation, much like the far right in 1933, whose ideas have been completely discredited in foreign policy and economic policy. He was this close to be able to drive a stake in them so they would never get more than 25% of the vote of people under 30 for 20 years. He was that close. He's not only not done that by his policies, as far as I can tell, he's put the stake down, tied his hands behind his back, helped these guys up off the mat, dusted them off, put them up on the pedestal, and he might actually hand power to them. And he might actually allow this group, through his actions, assume power at the White House, even Congress, by 2012. And it will be a far right that will make us long for George W. Bush. And that's why he could go down as the worst president in American history. That's why we need KBOO. So let you check.
And on that happy note, I kind of like people on the left having passion. I've seen a little too much of it on the right of late. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. I wrote a book on an American history of opposition to empire. And I've spent a lot of time on this topic. It's my great passion because I don't think you can be an empire and a democracy. You know, James Madison was right. It's not possible. And it's interesting that our founders were so very imperfect men, but they got that one clear. And I share so much of your critique. I can't criticize you for what you come to. I will only offer this painful political counsel that the response to deep disappointment is not always at the moment of clarity where you awaken and you go, whoa, okay, I get it. You know, swift kick to the back of the head. I now realize that we must, you know, break the political system and create the cooperative commonwealth that was intended by, you know, the great progressives of our history. If that's what we get, great. And if all these people who get disenchanted go out and forge something bolder and better, fantastic. But unfortunately, you know, Bob and I spend so much of our time writing about media. Our young people, and frankly, everybody, our 90-year-olds as well, are marinated in a media that is so unbelievably horrible in how it covers things. Right, KBOO's great. I want KBOO 800,000 watts broadcasting. But I have terrible news for you that there are some people who don't always tune into KBOO.
And I could care less about Fox. It's not, I'm not grumbling about Fox here. I'm saying mainstream American media is so problematic that my great fear is that as people become disenchanted with what has happened with Obama, with Democrats, whatever, is not that they get angry, passionate. That's great. I don't even mind if they swing over and become Tea Party. If that's where their passions take them, you know, all over the place. My fear is that they just say, this thing it doesn't work. No. Getting involved doesn't work. The response to that often is, I'm just checking out of this thing. I'm not going to vote. I'm going to try and make money. You know, maybe the only way I can get rich. But you know what? One of the great oral history projects I did was with veterans of the Spanish Civil War. These were communists and socialists who went to fight against fascism. And then they all got red-baited. And many of them were forced out of their jobs with unions. And in the 50s, they really had a tough time. But they were really smart. They were all organizers. And you know what a disproportional number of them became? Millionaires. No! They were like, they literally were blacklisted out of their jobs in factories and in unions and stuff like that. And so they would go into real estate or something. And they say, you know, this thing is so corrupt, I'm going to have to figure out, I got to get secure. That's what I worry about, that this moment we could really turn, as Bob suggests, a whole bunch of people off the track.
You know, I think that there's one other thing I'd like to add, because such an important point. You know, we're in this electoral treadmill or cycle or vicious cycle, whatever, I don't know the proper term to use, where, you know, I was very active in the Nader campaign in 2000, and I was active in it because once in a generation you get a shot to try to get outside of the two-party cycle, and it failed. And it failed not because Nader only got 2% of the vote or 4% or whatever 2.7%. That was fine. It failed because Nader didn't do what he promised. And he promised he's building a movement. It wasn't an ego trip for people just to make a vote so they could feel good about themselves. And the way I organized on that was we're building something that's going to try to build something that gets us out of this two-party rat race. And ultimately, he just wanted an ego trip thing, frankly. And I'll tell this Ralph to his face. I mean, I was on his organizing committee. And it was just about a protest vote. It wasn't about building anything that's going to last and get a candidate to community roots. It was about his ego. And he was hurt that he wasn't being respected enough. But he ruined the third-party option for a generation. Because for a generation, it's going to take another 12 years before anyone can credibly raise that. Because the feeling that you let George W. Bush through the door. And it's not an irrational response. I mean, because the problem with third parties in our electoral laws is you always end up helping one of the other two you hate the most. And then you might not mind that because you're so pissed off. But rank and file people who are affected by these policies do mind it a lot. And you're not going to organize diddly. So the reason I said it is I think that's why we have this demoralization so great today. It's because we're sort of confronting the same situation we've been confronting for a long time. It doesn't feel like we've gotten anywhere. It feels like it's even a deeper morass we're in today than we were 8 years ago or 12 years ago. And it looks like such a gloomy period coming up in front of us. And I don't really have a solution to that. I don't think anyone does. And I'm not sure how we get out of this crisis we're in. In a way that, you know, what we have to avoid on the left is what Ralph Nader did, which is you're going to make your symbolic protest, which is completely meaningless and accomplishes nothing. But you feel better, more pure than people who actually are going with you. So, but I don't have a solution. I guess the only solution is support CAVU.
Yeah.
Well, given the idea that sort of just opting out and sort of being very revolutionary isn't necessarily realistic, what are the realistic ways to sort of play in the system but still be effective, to not just be Barack Obama and not be effective, but sort of to make strategic compromises or changes away from the sort of pure path, but still be headed toward the right goal?
Great question. John, I'll let you answer that.
Oh, thanks, Bob. Well, these are the four things you must do. Take your notes. No, I don't want to compromise. I don't think we're talking about, you know what I mean? I understand your language, and I might well have used it a second ago, but now that you used it, I'll tell you something else. But I don't want compromise, and I don't want to get off the strategic path. What I think is absolutely essential, and it's driven home so powerfully by this moment, is that in the history of the United States, most of our radical progress, most of it, has come out of two kind of pools, if you will. One is a critical juncture, a moment at which a whole bunch of things happen, some of which you can control, some of which you can't, that demand a response and make, you know, create an opening. The Great Depression was such a moment. This confluence of events, and I still don't think I have yet to see anybody who's written anything particularly valid about the 1960s, but I think at some point somebody's going to do a story of the 1960s, and it's going to be something incredible. And what they're going to say is, you know, somehow we got a whole bunch of people to figure out that civil rights and stopping wars and all that really was a good idea. And we got beat on a lot of things, but we also accomplished a lot of it, you know, real fast. And maybe Kennedy's assassination was the critical juncture, and we didn't even see it as such, but boy, it just ricocheted, and all sorts of things happened. So critical junctures matter, and you ought to always watch for them. And I tell you, I hope I'm wrong about this in some ways, for the human turmoil. But the economic decline that began officially on September 15th, 2008, you know, it's possible that we will kind of have this sort of soft landing and have a Japan kind of scenario, right? Where we're sort of in a
wallow.
Yeah, we'll wallow, but it won't. You know, we'll wallow with our chin slightly above water level. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There you go.
We're lucky.
That's the lucky scenario. The unlucky scenario is the appropriately named W recession, right? And you know, W recession is that you dip once. Come up a little bit, you think, wow, maybe, you know, kind of, you know how W is shaped there, right? So you think you're coming up, and you're feeling, and then,
or better yet, the L.
Some really dark economic times, like tomorrow. But that's critical juncture. That's real, and then you can go one of two ways. And my friend Tony Benn, the great British parliamentarian, always says, you know, the most fascinating thing about the Great Depression was how people responded to it, you know, around the world, and that seemingly equally educated and functional countries went very, very different ways. The United States sort of dumb-lucked into Roosevelt and wasn't perfect, but some good stuff came there. Germany went another route. And so it becomes very volatile. That's the one part. So I've talked, you know, I said that's if we're coming to a critical juncture, I don't want us to be compromised. I want us to be very, very pure. I think the right's going to have a very pure response to bad times. We better have a pure response that's as energetic and powerful and able to attract people to us, because we don't want everybody to look for whoever's got an answer. So that's one. The other thing is local. Local matters. It always has in the history of this republic. You know, everything about the New Deal was started in the states first, and progressive states. Oregon, actually, was way ahead on a lot of reform issues. Wisconsin, where I'm from. And I think that at times where we are deeply frustrated about the federal, it's the most important time I got to just put my energy on hold until I see something better at the, you know, national and international stage. That's a time to burrow back in at the local level and try and, A, you know, really solve problems for real people here where we live, but also try and create models that are different and better. And, you know, you folks have already made this huge commitment. You're here at a KBOO fundraiser, right? You know, and you're committed to this. And creating great local media that makes people smarter and better. You know, that matters. That matters maybe more now than ever. And also extending that into the community in deep and functional political initiatives and economic initiatives and social initiatives matters. When I get frustrated, right, I look for a critical juncture. If there's one, I got to dive in no matter what. But if I do, you know, whatever that. I also, if I'm frustrated at something national and international, I go home. I go home to my community, and I try to really burrow in and do hard work there, because I always want to do some kind of activism.
You've made your focus on policies of Obama that failed to differentiate him from Clinton or Bush, policies regarding the economy, policies regarding foreign policy. I see one other thing that I had a hope for, and maybe I was very naive and foolish, but I was shamed by George Bush. He murdered people. He committed torture. And we now have a president who has a new attorney general able to open these ugly things and go after them. We also see that, we talk about Wall Street, they apparently did things I would call fraud by selling things to pension funds that were garbage. Shouldn't people go to jail for this? And I want to open that avenue of discussion up. I know that, you know, it's a very different avenue. Wouldn't it have been smart for this man to identify an enemy?
Well, let me just answer that first. John actually wrote a book called The Genius of Impeachment, which is, I think, your best book. Till this,
I kind of like the new
till
one.
Till this one. You did it on your own. It's your best one. And it makes, I think, a very powerful case that you have to apply the rule of law to people in power, or else your governing system is a farce and ultimately will unravel. And so I think both of us would agree completely with what you're saying. And I will not sit around trying to justify not applying the rule of law to people who break laws and kill it. I just don't think it's acceptable, and I couldn't agree more.
I will add that I think the Genius of Impeachment makes a fine holiday gift.
Not as fine as
book by Nichols and McChesney. But I do think that we're talking about two things here. We're talking about what is right, and it is politically smart to keep alive the memory of the sins of the previous administration so that people do not forget. Prosecution is the punishing. You know, that's about it. Impeachment is supposed to take away the benefits of office from someone who has so diminished the office by their presence and by their association with it. And the interesting thing is the founders actually believed that you could impeach someone after they left office. And in fact, they thought it was a very big deal, very important thing. And especially because he seems to think he is still running the country. And I'm sort of joking a little bit here, but not that much. I do think that the accountability moment was never had for this administration and the previous administration. And for so long as that is the case, the Obama administration will be disempowered.
On that note, I think, unfortunately, we have to start moseying over to get our game faces on for the Powell event.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thank you.